That experience by Brian Wilson could be described as self-forgetfulness, but it could also be described as remembering oneself. As we've heard on the show before, the main job of military training is to brutalize people to the extent that they become willing to kill on demand. And whilst it was quite an extreme circumstance in which he found himself, Brian Wilson was able to shake off that training in an instant and worked for peace from then on in. Now, I'm convinced that humanity has the potential to shake off the psychopathic value sets, particularly the according importance to this abstract thing we call money, but will it take such extreme provocation before people are ready to do this? In our second hour, we're going to hear about people who are looking to expand the human realm of consciousness and the human realm of conscience to embrace animals, so often forgotten or seen as not important. Let's start with a short clip from British philosopher, the late Alan Watts.
Dolphins spend most of their time playing. They don't work, because the grocery is right there in the ocean, whatever they need. And so a dolphin will catch up with a seagoing liner, and it'll get on the wake of the liner and put its tail at an exact angle of 26 degrees. And in so doing, the liner will carry the dolphin along. The dolphin will make circles around the liner just for fun, playing all its life in the water. And we know that a dolphin's brain is as big, if not bigger than ours, that it's incredibly intelligent, that it has a language which we can't decipher. And the person who knows most about dolphins in the United States, Dr. John Lilly, is a friend of mine, and he said he came to the conclusion that dolphins were too smart to tell us their language. So he abandoned this project. He said he would no longer keep such a highly civilized being in the concentration camp of the zoo, and that it should go back to the ocean. So the point is, though, that every, not only dolphins, but every organism that has any sensitivity in it whatsoever considers itself to be the center of the universe.
I should credit Derek Jensen for the books A Language Older Than Words and A Culture of Make-Believe as helping me to understand the possibilities of communicating with animals. Now, yesterday on the ferry, I saw seagulls playing in the water because there were exciting vortices coming out of the engines of the ferry. Now, if I was a scientist, maybe I would have thought, no, they're not playing, they're practicing their motor skills because they see it as a chance to increase their fitness. But it's a double standard because, I mean, who, as a parent, looks at their kids and says, well, they like going on the swings because it gives them a chance to evolve their balance mechanism? Why not just say they're having fun? Our next speaker, Jonathan Balcombe, talks about the quiet revolution which is occurring in science as far as the understanding and description of animals. So this is largely a rejection of what we saw last week, the behaviourist, reductionist approach which values animals and, of course, people by extension for what you can get out of them. This is looking at the value in their own terms, as if they have inherent value and inherent beauty, wisdom, culture. And of course, this is in harmony with a deeper acceptance of each other and the natural world, which is necessary if we are to survive and fundamentally change direction from the self-destructive course of the previous century.
We are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Dr. Jonathan Balcombe. Jonathan Balcombe is a research scientist with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. He has contributed to more than 30 academic journals and book chapters, including Animal Behavior, The American Biology Teacher, The Journal of Applied Animal Welfare Science, Contemporary Topics in Laboratory Animal Science, and The British Medical Journal. His books include The Use of Animals in Higher Education, Problems, Alternatives, and Recommendations, Pleasurable Kingdom, Animals and the Nature of Feeling Good, and he is here to talk about his new book, Second Nature, The Inner Lives of Animals. Start out, and before we get into your book, maybe if you could just briefly tell us about the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine.
Sure. PCRM is a nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C., founded in 1984, that focuses on better health through prevention, in particular with a focus on plant-based diets. They also work for higher standards in research, testing, and education, and that means specifically working to replace the harmful use of animals in those endeavors.
So tell us, what was the motivation in writing your new book, Second Nature?
Two things, really. One is there is a lot of exciting science coming out about animal behavior, animal sentience. What are animals thinking and feeling? These were questions that weren't being asked by scientists through much of the 20th century. And in the last 30, 40 years, there's been a burgeoning of interest in that area. There's even a journal now on animal cognition focused on animal minds. So, but a lot of this information gets buried away in the scholarly journals, the peer-reviewed literature, and the public, many of whom are hungering for this information, doesn't have easy access to it. So a big part of the reason for writing this book is to make this information accessible to the public. Second reason is our troubled relationship with animals. We kill more animals per year now than at any other time in history, mainly to eat them. About 98 of every 100 animals is killed to be eaten, and we're talking close to 100 billion animals a year worldwide. So it's a big problem, and there's a lot of suffering involved in that. And it links to global warming as well and human health issues. So a huge issue there, and I think that a lot of people are swayed when they learn that animals actually have rich inner lives, that they're aware, that they have lives that matter to them. So by bringing that information to light, I'm hoping that people will move towards a better relationship to other animals.
Do you have a sense for why there is more research going on with what's happening with animals now?
I guess it's a sort of a philosophical change in the way science works. Science goes through phases of, all human culture goes through phases, different phases. In the case of science, there was just a period through the 20th century where it was thought that because animals' experiences were private, then there was no point in asking questions about them and trying to understand them. So it was sort of a form of terminal agnosticism, as one scientist has called it. And then in the late 20th century, that kind of broke down, and we have a new era now where it's not taboo anymore, and it's a legitimate stuff, and you can ask questions about what animals think and feel, and you can devise very clever experiments to show that animals actually have, emotional changes to things, and that they're thinking about things. They have good memories, and that they have culture and even virtue, and we can talk about those things.
All right, good. I hope you bring up some examples of that. So you have the envious job of then of going through and seeing the latest cutting-edge research on this. Maybe you can give us some examples of some of the unique capabilities that animals have that until, recently we didn't assume that they did.
Sure, and there's so many. Where to start? I mean, I could start with fishes. Fishes are not just, we say fish or fishes, I mean, there's 27,000 odd species of them, so they're a hugely diverse group and they have different capabilities in their own right. But we've often dismissed them as kind of mindless, cold-blooded automatons that, because they don't scream when they're in pain, they don't have facial expressions that we recognize. We just assume they're kind of things, not much more than a block of wood. But actually, fishes have inner lives. They have complex social behavior in many cases. And so it's been really fun to delve into the literature and see what's going on in the fish world. There's a book called Fish Cognition and Behavior that was published about 4 years ago. And it's a scholarly volume, but just the fact that there's a book devoted to that is impressive. I could just give one example of an interesting social behavior in fishes. There's these things called cleaning stations. They're typically on reefs, although some other habitats have them. And there's certain fishes like the cleaner wrasse who have a sort of a cleaning service that they offer to other fishes. And it's sort of like a barbershop, opening up for business. And the wrasse swims in a certain way to signal his or her readiness to service other fishes. And other fishes will actually line up to wait their turn to be given this sort of spa treatment where the cleaner fish kind of plucks over their skin, removes sloughing skin and ectoparasites and things like that. So the cleaner fish benefits by getting some nutrition and the clients benefit by getting sort of this spa treatment. And there's every indication that the clients enjoy this treatment. And this sort of behavior is known from other groups too. Hippos are also cleaned by fishes and they seem to enjoy that. And there's even a case where warthogs in parts of Africa will lie down and these mongooses will clamber over them and pluck away at their skin and nibble away. And I guess they're getting little tidbits and that they like. And the warthogs, as far as we can tell, they're just absolutely loving this. I have a photo of that. Yeah. So that's an interesting behavior. In the case of the fishes, though, it gets Machiavellian because sometimes the cleaner fish will take a little nip. It's sort of a cheating behavior. And then quickly swim away, knowing he or she's done a bad thing. And the client, if it's a new client, will often chase that fish. If they're a long-established relationship, that probably won't happen anyway because you don't want to cheat on a good, valued business partner. And other fishes observe these interactions. They actually form image scores. That's the scientist's term, image scores for how these cleaners do their job. And if they're inclined to nip, then they won't get many clients. So it's pretty complicated and surprising for a fish, for an animal we didn't think was aware and had things going on. There's things like culture, orcas, these are killer whales. There's seals off the coast here and further north who live among orcas year-round, resident orcas. And those orcas have a particular dialect. And the seals recognize that dialect and they're comfortable with that when they hear those orcas calling because they don't attack seals. But there's migratory ones that come through twice a year that do pursue and attack seals. And they have a different dialect. And the seals have learned to translate the dialects and they recognize that dialect. And when they hear that, they head for the hills or more like they head for the kelp beds and the coast to avoid them. So that's an interesting case of culture in one species and another species interpreting the different language and acting accordingly.
Talk more about that, the whole concept of language and vocabulary. That seems that would be something unique just to humans.
That's right. We've sort of been language supremacists, and we've sort of thought we were the only ones with language. And we have a very special language. We have a great language, and we can do wonderful things with their language. But we have to realize other animals are good at what's useful to them. They live in their own worlds. They have their own sensory abilities. And they have ways of communicating that are meaningful to them and that are useful to them. It's not very useful for prairie dogs to talk about different computer platforms, but it's very useful for prairie dogs to have terms for different types of predators because, unfortunately for prairie dogs, they have a lot of enemies out there in the prairies where they live. And they have a special call for an eagle or a hawk, an aerial predator that's very dangerous. The proper response to that call is to head for the nearest burrow and head down the burrow and don't stay at the entrance. If it's a coyote call, then they head to the burrow and just remain vigilant at the entrance. If it's a domestic dog that someone spotted and they make this particular alarm call for a domestic dog, the proper response is just to stay alert where you are, unless the dog's right near you and then you want to run to the burrow. If it's a human, you pretty much want to get out of the way, and they quickly modify different calls for shapes, sizes, colors. One study showed that a human carrying a gun, if a human discharges a gun into the ground 5 days in a row in the colony, prairie dog colony, the prairie dogs will quickly begin to modify the call to indicate that it's a human carrying a gun, and they will respond differently to that sound. And when you consider that these populations of these animals have declined 98% since before Europeans came on the scene, largely through habitat loss and persecution with guns, perhaps it's not surprising that they modify their calls for a human carrying a gun.
Are there any other animals that have vocabulary specific to identify humans?
Probably. I believe vervet monkeys do. And these, by the way, these are just animals that have been studied closely. I mean, most animals don't get studied closely in the wild. But when we do study an animal in the wild, we discover, or in captivity, but wild I think is a purer way to study them. We discover things about them we just didn't realize before. So there's so much going on there, and even animals who've been well studied, there's probably a lot more going on below the surface, so to speak, that we're just not party to. And it's only when we get up close and personal and study them, and particularly long-term studies are useful, like Jane Goodall-type studies where it's over decades, and in particularly long-term, long-lived animals, such as elephants, baboons, and things like that. There's some really interesting discoveries about them because you get to know who's related to who and how they respond differently to those relatives.
And with a lot of those studies, do they have a specific goal when they're going in to look at those behaviors, or is it just something they discover in kind of an overall observing this over time?
It's a good question. It's really a combination of the two, because by living up close to animals, you make happenstance observations, and those observations, those original anecdotes, generate questions. So, for instance, when baboon mothers have been observed who've lost an infant, their behavior changed. And so the scientists were intrigued by that. So let's study this more closely. Let's start collecting their poop and analyzing it for hormones, which we can now do. We no longer have to catch them and dart them and draw blood, which is very stressful, which affects hormone levels. So now we can collect, scientists can collect feces from these animals. And lo and behold, when a mother baboon loses an infant, her glucocorticoid hormone levels in her bloodstream go up in a pronounced way for a month or more. And this actually echoes the physiological response of a woman who loses a child as well. Our hormones go up, and theirs do in a very similar way. And then in behaviorally, they also respond similarly to women who've lost an infant. We rally around. We offer moral support, sort of a social network. We deliver flowers. I don't think baboons deliver flowers as far as is known, but they do expand their social networks. They groom more. They receive more grooming from other baboons. And it's thought to be a form of therapy that helps them to recover from this bereavement. And bereavement is the term the scientists use. All indications are that these animals are feeling grief at the loss. Incidentally, just recently there was a new study on chimpanzees, mothers who'd lost infants, and they will often carry their infant around for days, even weeks. One mother carried her infant around for 68 days following death. So if that isn't an indication of some level of emotional attachment to that infant, I don't know what is.
And I don't know if, are baboons used in research here in the U.S.?
They are indeed. I'm currently actually looking at some records of baboons from a lab. These animals are often wild-caught. They may be captive-born. To me, it doesn't really make much difference. And then they are used for things like H1N1 viral research, hepatitis research, various forms of research that are intrinsically harmful to those individuals. And beyond the actual experimental paradigm itself, there's the issue of the daily grind of living in a lab. The animals are often singly housed. Some labs are better than others about trying to give them social housing, but they're caged. They're in confined circumstances, usually indoors, and they're subjected regularly to unpleasant procedures, handling and restraint, injections, blood collection, sometimes 100 or more of those during their years in the lab. And very few of them make it out of the lab. There are a few sanctuaries now for animals to retire to, but the great majority, probably well over 99% of animals in labs, monkeys included, but certainly rats and mice, end up being killed either in the research or at the termination of the study.
And in addition to suffering that themselves, do they suffer when they perceive their others in their group enduring these things?
That's an insightful question, because there actually has been some investigation into this, what's called witnessing effects. And I was actually looking at the literature some years ago for a review paper on how routine laboratory procedures can cause stress in animals. And one of the things that's being tested by scientists is, how does it affect a rat or a mouse if another rat or a mouse is being killed in the same room or caused pain? And these things can be measured. And indeed, the stress hormone levels in these witnessing animals go up when that happens. An interesting study, not a very nice study, I'm glad I wasn't a mouse in this study, but mice who are writhing in pain from injections into the stomach or the feet, if there's another mouse in the cage next door who can witness them through a barrier, a pane of glass, on witnessing this mouse writhing will themselves become much more sensitive to pain. But there's two provisos. One is only females, not males, and two is it's only if they know that other mouse. So it's sort of a socially mediated thing. It's not just a sort of a stimulus response thing, which we so often simplify animals to doing, just stimulus response. No, the mouse is aware of who specifically that is who's writhing on the other side of that barrier. And if they know that mouse, a sibling or perhaps a cage mate, they will show a heightened pain response themselves.
One would expect in the non-human primates, because they are supposedly so close to humans, a lot of human traits and characteristics, but I think it's it would be surprising to a lot of people that mice and or rats would be going through these traumas. And I remember last time we interviewed you about your previous book, Pleasurable Kingdom, you had talked, I think it was about rats and laughter. Can you briefly touch on that?
Sure. There's an American neuroscientist named Jaak Panksepp, And he's done some very interesting investigations into this sort of a mirthful response in rats. Young rats play a lot, and one of their common play behaviors is to flip each other onto their backs and then kind of tickle each other in the belly. And it turns out rats love this. And so what Jaak and his colleagues did was they took a group of rats and they divided them into two groups, and then they each rat was... You know, I'm going to make this simpler and much shorter than that long explanation. Let me put it this way. Rats who have been trained to expect to be petted on the neck, just the hand gently stroking them on the back, they will come to the hand. They like that. But rats who have trained to be expecting, when they go into this arena, to expecting to be flipped on their back and tickled in the belly as they do when they play with each other, they will run to the hand on average 4 times as quickly. And scientists like to measure things because that gives you a quantitative comparison. So they like both, but they absolutely love to be tickled in the belly. And then by recording their sounds, and these are ultrasonic sounds, we can't hear them, which is an important point. A lot of this stuff goes on outside our sensory bandwidth, and we need to use special equipment or use videotape and slow it down to see some subtleties and nuances that are going on that we may not have noticed before. So in this case, when you monitor their calls, these ultrasonic calls, it shows that they're making these really high-pitched chirping sounds. And those are indicative of the areas of the brain that are active during these behaviors are the same areas that are active when we're laughing at a joke or we're sort of feeling mirthful or being tickled. So there's both behavioral and physiological parallels. Again, sort of like the baboon's bereavement in case of rat mirth, there's good rigorous science supporting the fact that they're experiencing a similar sort of affect, a similar kind of emotional, physical response to being tickled that we would have when we're tickled.
Do you think this also applies to mice? Are they that close, you know, in the animal hierarchy? And also, if they have laughter at a frequency we cannot hear, could they also be suffering or, you know, pain and or doing, you know, screaming at a level that we couldn't hear?
That's part of the problem is we're not tuned into their bandwidth, as I say. And for a long time, no one was asking questions about how the equipment in labs might be affecting these animals who have sensory hearing at high pitches. And a lot of the computers and the lights that we use, someone finally set up the equipment to show that these things are sometimes putting out some pretty high decibel sounds. It's just that we don't hear it, but they do. And so that is a major welfare concern. And your question about how mice compare to rats... They're radically different. They look very similar superficially, and they're related as small rodents. But they have different forms of social life, somewhat different ways of communicating. But there are also some very strong parallels as well. And as I just mentioned, the empathy study in mice. And by the way, that's that study where a mouse was writhing and another animal became more sensitive to pain. The conclusion was a sort of a form of empathy is what these mice were showing. So empathy is not an emotion we would have applied to mice a while ago, and now that's beginning to happen. We're realizing these animals have much more complex lives. Mice are highly perceptive of what they do. They also have ultrasonic calls. It's a social courtesy to leave a little dribble of urine when you're moving around. It would be considered rude in our society, but in mice, it's a normal behavior. And other mice are able to divine a lot of information from that urine. They can tell male or female, of course, but they can also tell, estimate how old that other mouse was. They, of course, will recognize individuals that way, so it may be someone they know and they're cooler with that. But if it's someone they don't know, if it's a male mouse, they may be uptight about that. They can even detect parasite loads from the urine that another mouse leads. So sometimes the other mouse leaving the urine trail is leaving information perhaps that they would rather not leave, but there it is, it's available.
Talk a bit about the different animals that we consume on a daily basis as part of our food. So I'm thinking like the traditional farm animals, chickens, pigs, cows. Can you tell us anything about them?
Sure can. They're being well studied. There's a lot of them out there. And we have this common assumption that animals in captivity or animals raised for food are somehow dimmer or duller. And that's just not true. I think maybe it makes us feel more comfortable about putting them on our plates if we can reduce them somehow. But they're as sentient and aware as the next animal. Studies with chickens show that they also have an alarm calling system. They have separate different calls for large, medium, and small aerial predator, and they respond appropriately to these sounds. They have a rooster has a come hither call for hens if he finds some food, and he, it's sort of a social favor. He'll call her over, she'll come over, and he'll let her have the food. It's very gallant, and of course, if you're cynical enough, you'll realize he's probably buying some credit for to be traded in at a future time. So that requires individual recognition and memory and monitoring of others, like those fishes do. Sometimes they will cheat. Roosters will make a call when there's no food there. They only will do it if the hen's far enough away that she's not likely to detect the ruse. She comes running, and he does the usual thing, and, well, maybe the grasshopper jumped away. So, but hens are perceptive. They will recognize an inveterate cheater, so it doesn't pay to cheat too often in nature. Pigs have been shown to very quickly learn how a mirror functions in a recent study. They understand the concept of a reflection in a mirror. Pigs have been known to pick up the collars of other pigs that allow them to access to food, and it gives them a double portion in the day. So, and pigs are widely known now to be very, very intelligent. And then studies of cows show that they have eureka moments when they solve a problem. That was a study that came out a couple of years ago. Sheep have superb face recognition skills. They can remember 50 or so of their original flock mates 2 years after they were taken out of their flock, just from single photographs, either straight on or profile. They also prefer the picture of a smiling human face over a frowning one, and they would rather go through a door that has a photo of a just fed and presumably contented sheep than a photo of a very hungry and presumably stressed sheep, even though they look similar to us. And that, to me, says a lot. It says that they have acute face recognition skills, but also they're reading the emotions of other sheep. And if they're reading the emotions of other sheep, well, the sheep are feeling emotions. This shouldn't surprise us, but again, science wasn't even asking questions about that. And it's so easy for us to dismiss these animals as simple and dim. And that's just not the case. They have, as I like to say, rich, complex inner lives, hence the title of my book, The Inner Lives of Animals.
So go back to the pigs and a mirror. Is that the concept, self-recognition? Is that?
It was just seeing how quickly they learned to grasp that if they see something that's actually in a mirror, that the object isn't just in line with what they're seeing. It's actually on the other side of a barrier. And then they can quickly learn to go around that barrier. They know that that's where it is. And so the study was just cleverly designed to show that they very quickly grasped that. And essentially, I think, one trial learning.
All right. And then, Cal, what is a eureka moment?
A eureka moment is kind of like when you celebrate a new discovery. In this case, they had to solve a problem. They had to find a button and push it to open a gate to access to food or outdoor pasture, things they like to do, to have access to. And cattle who had the door opened automatically without doing anything just kind of went through. But cattle who had caused it to open because of something they did, they actually found this button, they would kick up their legs, they just tossed their head, they showed behaviors that were indicative of a sort of a celebration, a feeling of surprise and excitement about solving a problem.
Talk a bit about our common house pets, cats and dogs. Anybody that has a pet is sure that their pet has these unique qualities that,
sure,
that nobody else's does.
Yeah, when I give talks about animals, I ask the audience, put your hand up if you think that cats and dogs are not emotional, and very rarely does any hand go up. If you've lived with them, you know that they have complex inner lives. And some dogs are being studied a lot now. They're a great subject because they've lived with us and manipulated us for 15,000 years or so, and so they're good to work with. A recent study shows fairness awareness in dogs, where if two dogs are offered a hand to shake, and these are dogs who've learned that trick of offering a paw to shake a hand, they happily do that 30 times or more. But the minute you introduce treats, it gets Machiavellian, and if one dog's receiving treats and the other one isn't, the other dog will soon stop offering the paw and will turn away. Apparently objecting to the imbalance of treatment. It's been shown in monkeys as well. They have this inequity aversion or fairness awareness. So the roots of morality lie well beyond humans. Play behavior requires restraint, and animals are often behaving good to each other. They help raise young of others and this sort of thing. And I discussed that at some length in Second Nature. And it's just another facet of animal lives that we've only recently been tuning into. So virtue is an exciting new frontier in the study of animal behavior.
How do you respond to people that say that the ideas you're pushing forward are just junk science?
I must say, people haven't put it that way to me. You're the first one, Mike. I object to that. No, I know you don't feel that way. I've never heard anyone... people take this stuff seriously. They're really interested, and I'm encouraged by that. Because, you know, speaking of virtue, we have a long way to go in virtue towards other animals. I'm encouraged by our ability to rise above past wrongs. You know, we used to have a slave trade. Colonialism has largely gone by the by, and women now have the right to vote around the world, and the civil rights movement has had huge success, of course. So we can rise above our old might makes right ways of thinking, but we still, our relationship to animals is still a might makes right one. I mentioned how many we kill earlier. We cage them, we torture them, we do things to them that we would never accept doing to our fellow human. And so that's sort of the deeper message of my book and my writings on animals more broadly, is to get people to reflect on that relationship. And really where the rubber meets the road, Mike, on this issue is meat. It's food. It's people eating animals. If people continue to eat animals, then, well, there's only so much we can do to advocate for animals and to prevent suffering if we advocate for them between bites of a cheeseburger. The animal, the meat industry and the dairy industry are the industries that cause far and away the most suffering and harm to animals worldwide.
So do you see it as a legitimate step in moving from the large agro-industrial production of animals towards, let's say, a small farmer organic run operations?
Yeah, the planet cannot sustain 6.5 billion people eating a meat-centered diet, and that's kind of unfortunately the direction we're moving in right now. Vegetarianism is catching on here in the West, but the parts of Asia, particularly China and India, they're rushing to catch up to Western lifestyles, and that's unfortunately turning us in the wrong direction. Certainly family farms, smaller farms would be a big step in the right direction, but I certainly encourage people to be vegetarian or vegan. I've been vegan for over 20 years, and it's obviously healthier. Well, it's not only is it healthy and good for the environment, but first and foremost, it's a much more humane relationship to animals. So I hope we'll look back on the 21st century as the century for animals, because that is the next great social movement. We need to change this very troubled, exploitative relationship we have to them.
All right. In addition to your book, Second Nature, The Inner Lives of Animals, do you have a website people can turn to?
I do. It's www and then my name. So it's jonathanbalcom.com.
Now, thanks to Mike McCormack of Mind Over Matters for that interview, which was from earlier this year. And the video interview is available from our website, unwelcomeguest.net/531. And there's more interviews of a similar vein at Mike's website, talkingsticktv.org, and there's a whole bunch on YouTube as well. Now, to close the show, we're going to have a speech. This is courtesy of Alex Smith's Radio Eco Shop, and I chose this to close the show because it talks about love, it talks about repentance, and it talks about forgiveness, and we can get lost under all the details of what's gone on and what is going on. If we are all one being, then the quest for blame is ultimately fruitless. And now here's Alex Smith.
Can corporations ever lead to a sustainable world? Now you'll hear the inside scoop from a woman who has been there and back, Anita Burke. This keynote speech is from October 21st at the 2009 Gaining Ground Summit in Vancouver, British Columbia. The meeting theme was Resilient Cities, Urban Strategies for Transition Times. Anita Burke moved the audience with her presentation, Shifting Corporate Culture. She is introduced by conference moderator Ron Abbott.
And now I think you need to strap in, because my friend Anita Burke is probably going to, in many respects, in many elegant respects, riff off of Nola Kate, certainly Bill, most everyone else who's already been into the podium, as well as some people that haven't. Anita has lived in the belly of the beast for many years. She was inside Shell International, trying mightily to shift the trajectory of that organization. For some time now, she has been outside of Shell, trying to shift the trajectory of businesses, communities, and other organizations. She brings an authenticity and an energy that is breathtaking. Please join me in welcoming Anita Burke.
I feel so odd. I mean, look at me. I'm all wired up. I got all this technology. Wow. I guess I should get the best out of it while we can still use it, according to what Bill said. Does anybody else want to go have a drink? I'm willing to give up my 15 minutes if you just want to go get drunk. And I don't drink, so I'm kind of like, wow, what am I going to do? I don't even have any intoxicants left to get me through this. I'm just really grateful to be here. And Vancouver is my adopted second home. And I'm just so grateful to be home again and to be back here amongst my Canadian friends. I'm currently living in Boulder, helping my son get through college. They grow up a lot slower these days. Has anybody noticed that? I have. Yeah, it's like, God, you're 24. Are you done yet? Come on. It's a real delight to be here. And I think Gene's gotten enough thank yous. And what I want to thank everybody in the room here. And I want to thank everybody in the room here, not for what you've done, but for what I hope you will do in response to some of the things that Bill has shared with you and some of the things that I'll share with you today. Because Gene is serving to catalyze you here in this room. Because you are what is going to change what is happening on our planet. Much like Dr. Reese, I was a little stymied by the topic I was given, change corporate culture. And I went, oh, well, I'm really in trouble because I don't believe we can do that anymore. And I woke up at 5 o'clock this morning just, what am I going to say? How am I going to do this? I have to tell them the truth. I lived in the belly of the beast. I know what's going on there. And God bless them. They're trying really hard. And it's not enough, fast enough. And the architectures that are in there, and I'm all confused and everything else. And then I stopped and I said, wait a minute. It's not them. We are the corporate culture. We are the corporate culture. And we must own that. We must own it in a deep and humiliating way. Because I got to tell you the truth. Shell International and Best Buy and Sony and all these companies, you know, they don't just sit around making this stuff because it's like cool and they want to trash the planet. I mean, honestly, there's a lot of people who like to say, jerks. It's not true. They only make these things because guess what? Every single one of you in this room buys them. Full stop. You buy them because you have been intoxicated by advertising and by this construct that you're only valuable as a human being and when you have a bunch of money in the bank and when you are rich. And when you have a big house, and when you have a whole lot of cars, that is currently what we believe it means to be a human being that is valued. And so when I was asked, what does it mean to change the corporate culture, I had to turn that around. And I had to bring into this room the construct and the reality that we are a corporate culture. Let's see, I need to get this started. Thanks. And yeah, I know. Isn't she beautiful? That's my point. I usually don't use a lot of notes, and bear with me with the computer up here. I just want to point out I didn't print out my notes on purpose, and this is a prop for me. And stop printing stuff out, gang. Just be a little ugly and kludgy and put this up here, and let's use our electrons. Let's inconvenience some electrons instead of tearing down more trees. We've got the tech for now. Let's use it. And so I always love to put this up, and I want you all to just sit with this for a minute. Isn't she beautiful? And there's only one of them in the whole universe. And we are the most intelligent beings existing on this one island in space. And it's up to us. We are responsible for where we're at today and where we can possibly be in the future. I want to show you what a corporate culture rather than a loving, peaceful culture looks like right now. And I want to share with you some information from Chris Hodges today. He says, we can cut our consumption of fossil fuels, we can use less water, We can banish plastic like I'm asking you to do today. We can install compact fluorescent light bulbs. We can compost in our backyard. But unless we dismantle the corporate state, all those actions will be just as ineffective as the ghost dance shirts donned by First Nations warriors to protect themselves from the bullets of white soldiers at Wounded Knee. For the oil and natural gas industry, the coal industry, the arms and weapons manufacturers, industrial farms, deforestation industries, the automotive industry, and chemical plants will not willingly accept their own extinction. Corporations will continue and must continue by the very nature of the system to cannibalize the planet for the sake of money. And we collude in this with every choice we make every day in what we choose to buy or our transportation choices and our own blind chasing of the dollar. Let me give you a few relevant statistics about that just so you can understand the comparative analysis, because there's a whole lot going on in the world right now where people are like, okay, I'm going to compost, I'm going to save this, I'm going to do that. Let me give us a little bit of numbers about how effective those beautiful and important gestures are going to be. The damage done to the environment by human households is minuscule compared to the damage done by corporations. Municipalities and individuals use 10% of the nation's water, while the other 90% is consumed by agriculture and industry. Individual consumption of energy accounts for about a quarter of all the energy consumed. The other 75% is consumed by corporations. Municipal waste accounts for only 3% of the total waste production in the United States. We can and should live more simply, but it will not be enough if we do not radically transform the economic structure of the industrial world. We heard also about peak oil, peak everything, and also the status of resource availability on the planet, and just from Dr. Rees. And my great friend Rex Weiler has allowed me to use this slide, and I'm going to put up a set of things that we must do right now. And I know it's going to feel impossible. Many of you might say, oh, geez, maybe we have to do that, but there's no way we can. But Mike Harcourt told us today that we can, and he proved it. We don't have an 8-lane highway along our coast anymore. We can do this. And these are targets, and these are requests, and these, well, they're not requests, they're facts. We've done the math. This isn't politics. I'm politically agnostic. I'm a physicist. It's all about the numbers for me, you know? And quite frankly, I always tell people, if this is really not true, somebody has a moral responsibility to tell me and relieve my suffering. And that of everybody else. I mean, come on. I'm not attached to being a political warrior around environmental issues. I just want to survive, you know? And I want my kids to survive, and I want to be a grandma. And I know for a fact that our corporate structure and our collusion as a corporate culture is the sole thing that is destroying where we live. Are you ready? This is nail-biting, okay? When he sent them to me, I was like, there's no way. But the math says this is what we have to do. We have to eliminate cars and build public transport. And let me give you a fine example of that here right in Canada. We recently had a federal gift of $10,000 to make electric cars. Our resource limitations are so great right now that that is frightening to me. That money should have gone into solar-powered electric public rail transport. Full stop. No more cars. Thank you. To stop it, convert car spaces to food production and build soils. Building soil spiritually is man and woman's greatest responsibility on the planet. I want you to hold that too. That's all we're supposed to be doing here. We need to stabilize and reduce the human population. And that's going to come through women's rights and contraception. I'm not going to get into the issues of abortion and all those sorts of things, but I am going to get into the issue of empowering women first and foremost for the right to their decisions about their own bodies and to their right to live in a safe world that isn't violent against them with rape and pillage, and that we are recognized again as our as the life givers on this planet. I want you guys to think about that for a minute. Women give life, and we won't take advantage of your respect of us, I promise. And we deserve that respect. The feminine, everyone says, oh, we got to rise up. The women have to be there. Stop beating us up. Let us get up off our knees. Let us breathe and listen to us. And let us have rights for our own bodies. We need to reduce CO2 emissions by 80% immediately. It's interesting to see these new numbers that are bouncing around. I worked at Shell International. I was an advisor to the Senior Committee of Managing Directors on the issues of climate change and sustainability. And we were doing our initial research, and this was 10, 11 years ago. And at that time, in our modeling with MIT, before we had this new information from the International Panel on Climate Change, that things are happening 20 years faster than we anticipated, we said then, inside the industry, that we damn well better not go over 320. And I kind of come down off the mountain after being out of the corporate world for 10 years, and come down, and I'm kind of scratching my head, and I'm thinking, how come the baseline's 2005 now? What happened in 1990? You know, what the heck? What happened to all those emissions? And let me tell you something, they also know how to achieve that, and they still get to make a lot of money. Promise, cross my heart, hope to die, stick a needle in my eye. I've done it, I've seen it, I've done the technology work at refineries all over the world, and reducing the carbon footprint of the refining capacity of Shell International worldwide can be done with a capital investment ratio that results in an 83% return in 2.2 years. So take that profit, boys. That's going to get you there. And in addition to that, it also drives innovation and reduces it makes the money. They don't need to drill for more oil. They just need to make their current operations more efficient. It's a $60 billion opportunity annually alone for them. So when they cry and scream and yell at the political over the political debates and tell you that it's going to destroy the economy, you're all going to go broke, it's going to be worse than ever before, tell them that's a lie. And don't let them bully you, because it's not true. And they can do it, and they can do it in next year's capital allocation budget. And we need to demand that from them, because we are the corporate culture. So let's change our culture. We need to reduce the throughput of matter and energy in everything that we design. If we simply used energy return on energy invested as a screen for every capital investment, be it a repair of a road, a decision about whether to put in rail or build more highways, the answers would be very clear to us, and we would decarbonize this economy in the time frames necessary for our survival. And it's simple. It's like I don't have to write an 800-page manual to tell you how to calculate triple bottom line and all that sort of stuff. Just add energy return on energy invested into the current ROI calculations. Real simple. There's our silver bullet. We need to do 100% recycling of all materials, energy, and soil from organic waste. Full stop. Ecological building codes, heat pumps, insulate. Brilliant ideas here around that. We need to preserve all farmland and all forests and plant trees. This is critical to our survival. We need to preserve wilderness, diversity, symbiosis. We've got very little left. We're burning through it like crazy right now. And we need to reduce meat consumption. That's kind of hard for me. I get it. I'm an omnivore. I grew up with that. I like a good steak every once in a while. Believe me. But we got to do it. All right? That's another thing, to stop this. We need to prepare for dikes. One of the things that I'm really asking urban locations in coastal areas is to really embrace the fact that you are facing large-scale relocation of your populations in the next 5 to 10 years. Large scale. And if there's any more important planning discussion that needs to go on urgently, is how we're going to manage the relocation of massive amounts of climate change refugees from the coastal communities to the inner portions of our continents. This is very real. Trust me, the planning process 10 years, we'll be lucky if we can get it done in 10 years. It's a very laborious bureaucratic process. We need global education and literacy building. We need to localize. I can't embrace this enough. We need to localize and build resilient communities. The national and international political process and system cannot move fast enough and nimbly enough to deliver on the agenda and the systems conditions that are rapidly bearing down upon us. This has to be resolved at the local level. Vancouver needs to set a CO2 limit that's enforceable in its own city that gets us to 80%. We need to do it at the municipal and the county and the provincial level. It will not happen fast enough in those other architectures. Not because people don't have the will, but because the process itself, the bureaucratic process itself, is inhibiting. To get a regulation passed and have due process and to have public opinion and put everybody's input takes anywhere from 5 to 7 years. We don't have that kind of time. And more importantly, we're going to have to open to each other and take care of each other deeply and passionately. I'm going to move now into something that I think is important and the only way that we're going to change corporate culture. And I'll start with Martin Luther King. I adore him. And he says, our scientific power has outrun our spiritual power. We have guided missiles and misguided men and women. Our hope for creative living lies in our ability to reestablish the spiritual needs of our lives in personal character and social justice. Without this spiritual and moral reawakening, we shall destroy ourselves in the misuse of our own instruments. And so, how do we change our corporate culture? How do we do that? How do we address this? I believe fully that it is a function of learning to forgive ourselves and learning to forgive others. And that forgiveness at a deep, deep level for what we have done is critical to our survival. I'm going to read you a story about forgiveness to inspire you. There was an elderly black woman brought by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission face to face with the man, Mr. Vandenbroek, who had confessed to the savage torture and murder of both the woman's son and her husband a few years earlier. Sorry, this one always breaks me up. The old woman had been made to witness her husband's death. The last words of her husband had been, "Father, forgive them." One of the members of the commission turned to her and asked, "How do you believe justice should be done to this man who has inflicted such suffering on you, so brutally destroyed your family?" The old woman replied, "I want 3 things. I want to first be taken to the place where my husband's body was burned so that I can gather up the dust and give his remains a decent burial." She stopped, collected herself, and then went on. "My husband and son were my only family. I want, secondly, therefore, for Mr. Vandenbroek to become my son. I would like for him to come twice a month to the ghetto and spend a day with me so that I can pour out to him whatever love I have still remaining within me. And finally, I want a 3rd thing. I would like Mr. Vandenbroek to know that I offer him my forgiveness because Jesus Christ died to forgive. This was also the wish of my husband. And so I would kindly ask someone to come to my side and lead me across the courtroom so that I can take Mr. Vandenbroek in my arms, embrace him, and let him know that he is truly forgiven." The assistants came to help the old black woman across the room. Mr. Vandenbroek, overwhelmed by what he had heard, fainted. And as he did, those in the courtroom, friends, family, neighbors, all victims of decades of oppression and injustice, began to sing Amazing Grace. "How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me." You can hear this story and be deeply moved by it, but still think that its relevance to the gritty problems of world affairs and the collapse of our ecosystems and the earth is marginal. This is a mistake. Anyone who has been involved with the Palestinian-Israeli and the Indian-Pakistan conflicts, the two most dangerous conflicts in our world, must know by now that any purely political solution, a changing of boundaries, or the exchange of money or power has only a very small chance of working. In such extreme situations, and extreme situations characterize increasingly all realms of our world, only extreme solutions born from another dimension of truth and compassion have any real chance of being effective. There will be no end to the potential horror of more fish stocks disappearing, polar bears going extinct, and human beings starving to death every day, until a great many people on both sides have made the amazing and humbling journey of the elderly black woman to unconditional forgiveness. Not from a position of weakness or defeat, but from a mysterious inner experience of the nature of God as being one with all, embracing mercy. While dauntingly difficult, such a journey is by no means impossible. Countless numbers of anonymous and so-called ordinary beings have made it throughout history and are making it now. Such a height of unconditional forgiveness and embrace is also essential to the success of all major activism adventures in our world. Savage denunciation of corrupt corporations and lazy politicians and of a media in bed with systems of cold evil that want to keep exploiting the earth may have truth in its fury, but it has two main disadvantages in practical affairs. The excitement of projecting onto others our own unacknowledged darkness blinds us from seeing just how implicated we are and ensures that the advocacy of our case increases rather than heals resistance. Human beings are never going to be convinced to change their ways by other human beings who try to humiliate them through self-righteous contempt. In almost every case, such condemnation only reinforces the behavior it is trying to end. When someone is accused of something they know they are guilty of by someone who they can see has contempt for them, they nearly always retreat even further into their self-destructive behavior, or if they do change, it is from fear or even hypocrisy and not from their own truth. I'll close with two things. One, I'm inviting you to claim your sovereignty from the corporate culture. Reclaim your community. And in your community, fearlessly, urgently transform where you live, your neighborhood, into a sovereign, vibrant, sustainable state of love and peace that is not codependent on the corporate state. You still catch me
napping. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can. And keep forgiving all you can. If we want to be, we can be one global family.
When you realize what you've done that has been so painful, you do cry, as I have cried many times in 34 years since I was in Vietnam, for having committed so much harm from so much ignorance, and to realize that my whole civilization was built on killing the indigenous, killing Africans, and then killing people all over the world that were in the way of our getting what we wanted on our terms.